Heidi and Manfred were married on the bank of the Havel Lake in the garden of Colonel Sigmund Bolt's home in the Grunewald. It was a golden afternoon in early September, with the leaves turning yellow and red at the first touch of autumn. To be there, both Uncle Trump and Rolf Stander had stayed over when the Olympic teams scattered for home, and Rolf stood up with Manfred as his best man while Uncle Trump concluded the simple ceremony. Heidi was an orphan, so Sigmund Bolt gave her away, and there were a dozen or so of Heidi's friends, most of them her superiors and colleagues in the Ministry of Propaganda and Information. But there were others, her cousins and more distant relatives, in the black dress uniforms of the elite SS divisions, or the blue of the Luftwaffe, or the field grey of the Wehrmacht, and pretty girls, some of them in the traditional peasant-style dirndls, of which the Nazi Party so strongly approved. After the short and simple Calvinistic ceremony that Uncle Trump conducted, there was an al fresco wedding banquet provided by Colonel Bolt under the trees, with a four-piece band wearing Tyrolean hats and lederhosen. They played the popular party-approved music of the day, alternating with traditional country airs, and the guests danced on the temporary wooden floor which had been laid over the lawn. Manfred was so absorbed with the lovely new wife in his arms that he did not notice the sudden excitement amongst the other guests, or the way that Colonel Bolt hurried to greet the small party that was coming down from the house. Until suddenly, the band broke into the stirring marching song of the Nazi party, the Horst Wessel song. All the wedding guests were on their feet, standing rigidly to attention. And though he was puzzled, Manfred stopped dancing and stood to attention with Heidi at his side. As the small party of new arrivals stepped onto the temporary wooden dance floor, all the guests raised their arms in the Nazi salute and cried together, "Heil Hitler!" Only then did Manfred realize what was happening, the incredible honor that he and Heidi were being accorded. The man coming towards him wore a white jacket, buttoned high at the throat, with the simple iron cross for valor, its only decoration. His face was pale, square, and strong. His dark hair was brushed forward over his high forehead, and there was a small clipped moustache under the large, well-shaped nose. It was not an extraordinary face, but the eyes were like no others Manfred had ever seen. They seared his soul with their penetrating intensity. They reached to his heart and made him a slave forever. His right hand was still encased in plaster as he held the Nazi salute, and Adolf Hitler smiled and nodded. "I have heard that you are a friend of Germany, Herr de la Rey," he said. "I am of German blood, a true friend and your most ardent admirer. I can find no words to describe the great but humble honor I feel in your presence," said Manfred. "I congratulate you on your courageous victory over the American Negro." Adolf Hitler held out his hand. "And I congratulate you also on your marriage to one of the lovely daughters of the Reich." Manfred took the Führer's hand in his own undamaged left hand, and he was trembling and filled with awe by the significance of the moment. "I wish you great joy," Hitler continued, "and may your marriage forge iron links between yourself and the German people." The Führer's hand was cool and dry, the strong yet elegant hand of an artist, and Manfred's emotions welled up to choke him. "Always, my Führer, the links between us will last forever." Adolf Hitler nodded once more, shook hands with Heidi, smiled at her joyous tears, and then he was leaving as suddenly as he arrived, with a word and a smile for a few of the most important guests. "I never dreamed," whispered Heidi, clinging to Manfred's arm. "My happiness is complete. "That is greatness," Manfred said, watching him go. "That is true greatness. It is hard to think he is mere mortal and not a god." Sarah Bester pedalled down the main street of the little village of Stellenbosch, weaving through the light traffic, smiling and waving at anybody she recognised on the sidewalks. Her school books were strapped on the carrier behind the saddle of her bicycle. The skirt of her gym slip billowed up almost as high as her knees, and she had to keep clutching at her school hat. That morning, her class had been given the results of the previous term's work, and she was bursting with the need to tell Aunt Trudy that she had pulled up from fifth to second place. The headmistress had noted on her school report, "Well done, Sarah, keep up the good work." It was her last year. In October, she would be 17, and she would write her matriculation the next month. Manny would be so proud of her. It was his inspiration and encouragement which had done so much to make her one of the top girls in the school. She started to think about him now, daydreaming as she pedalled along under the oaks. He had been away so long, but soon he would be home. Then she would tell him, and it would all be all right. She wouldn't have to worry and cry alone at night. Manny would be back. Strong, kind, loving Manny would make it all right again. She thought of being married to him, cooking his breakfast, washing his shirts, darning his socks, walking to church at his side, calling him Meinir, the way Aunt Trudy called Uncle Trump, lying beside him every night, waking beside him every morning, and seeing his beautiful blonde head on the pillow beside her. And she knew there was nothing else in all the world she wanted. "Only Manny," she whispered. "Always and only Manny. He is all I have ever had, all I have ever longed for." Ahead of her, she saw the postman at the gate of the manse, and she jumped down off the bicycle and called, "Have you got anything for us, Mr. Grobler?" The postman grinned at her and took a buff-coloured envelope from his leather purse. "A telegram," he told her importantly. "A telegram from overseas. But it's not for you, little one. It's for your aunt." "I'll sign for it," Sarah scribbled in his receipt book, propped her bicycle on the gate of the manse, and flew up the front steps. "Aunt Trudy," she screamed, "a telegram. Where are you?" She smelt cooking odours and knew where to look. "It's a telegram." Sarah rushed into the kitchen. Aunt Trudy was standing over the long yellow wood table, with the rolling pin in her hands, flour to her elbows, and wisps of silver blonde hair tickling her nose, so that she blew at them as she straightened. She was glowing moistly from the heat of the kitchen range, and great pots of peach and fig jam bubbled over the flames. "Goodness me, what a to-do! You must learn to act like a lady, Sarah. You are not a child." "A telegram! Look, a real telegram! It's the first we've ever had." Even Aunt Trudy was impressed. She reached for it and then paused. "My hands are covered with flour. Open it, Sari." Sarah tore open the envelope. "Shall I read it out?" she demanded. "Yes, yes, read it out. Who is it from?" "It's from Uncle Trump. He signs it, Your Dutiful Husband, Trump Bierman." "Silly old man. He has paid for 4 unnecessary words," Aunt Trudy grumbled. "Read what he says." "He says, I have to inform you that Manfred was..." Sarah's voice tailed off into silence, and her bright, expectant expression crumbled as she stared at the sheet in her hands. "Go on, child," Aunt Trudy urged her. "Read it out." Sarah began again, her voice small and whispery. "I have to inform you that Manfred was today married to a German girl named Heidi Kramer. He plans to study at the University of Berlin and will not be returning home with me. I am sure you wish him happiness as I do. Your dutiful husband, Trump Biermann. Sarah lifted her eyes from the form, and they stared at each other.
I cannot believe, Aunt Trudy breathed. Not our Manfred. He wouldn't. He couldn't desert us.
Then she noticed Sarah's face. The child had gone grey as the ashes in the fireplace.
Oh, my little Sari.
Aunt Trudy's plump features collapsed with compassion and shared agony, and she reached for the girl. But Sarah let the telegram flutter from her fingers to the kitchen floor and whirled and raced from the kitchen. She snatched up her bicycle from the gate and stepped up into the saddle. She stood up on the pedals so as to drive harder, and her legs pumped to the beat of her heart. Her hat flew off her head and dangled down her back, suspended on the elastic around her neck. Her eyes were wide and dry, her face still grey with shock, as she raced out of the village, turning up past the old Lanzerach estate, heading instinctively for the mountains. When the track became too steep and rough, she dropped the bicycle and went on upwards on foot, through the pine forest until she reached the first crest. There she stumbled off the track and threw herself full length on the damp bed of pine needles, on the exact spot where she had given her love and her body and her soul to Manfred. Once she had recovered her breath after the hard run up the mountainside, she lay quietly, neither sobbing nor weeping, merely pressing her face into the curve of her own arm. As the afternoon wore on, so the wind veered into the northwest, and the clouds gathered on the high peaks above where Sarah lay. At dusk, it began to rain, and the darkness came on prematurely. The air turned icy, and the wind whimpered in the pines, shaking down droplets onto her prostrate body, until her gym slip was soaked through. She never lifted her head, but lay and shivered like a lost puppy, and her heart cried out in the darkness.
Manfred, Manfred, where did you go to? Why did I have to lose you?
A little before morning broke, one of the search parties from the village, which had scoured the mountainsides all night, stumbled upon her, and they carried her down the mountainside. "It's pneumonia, Mevrouw Biermann," the doctor told Aunt Trudy when she called him to the manse for the second time that next night. "You are going to have to fight for her life. She doesn't seem to want to fight herself." Aunt Trudy would not allow them to take Sarah to the new town hospital. She nursed the girl herself, tending her day and night in the small back bedroom, sponging the sweat and heat from her body while the fever mounted, sitting beside the bed and holding her hot hand through the crisis, not leaving her even when it had broken and Sarah lay pale and wasted, with the flesh melted off her face, so that her features were bony and gaunt, and her lacklustre eyes too large for the bruised cavities into which they had sunk. On the sixth day, when Sarah was able to sit up and drink a little soup without Aunt Trudy's assistance, the doctor made his final call, and behind the closed bedroom door gave Sarah a detailed examination. Afterwards, he found Aunt Trudy in the kitchen and spoke to her quietly and seriously. Once he had left the manse, Aunt Trudy went back to the bedroom and sat beside the bed, in the same chair on which she had conducted her long vigil. "Sarah," she took the girl's thin hand It was light and frail and cold. "When did you last have your courses?" she asked. Sarah stared at her without replying for long seconds, and then for the first time she began to weep. Slow, almost viscous tears welled up from the depths of those haunted, bruised eyes, and her thin shoulders shook silently. "Oh, my little girl." Aunt Trudy reached for her and held her to the bulky pillow of her bosom. "My poor little girl, who did this to you?" Sarah wept silently, and Aunt Trudy stroked her hair. "You must tell me..." Suddenly the gentling hand froze on Sarah's head in mid-stroke, as understanding crashed in upon her. Manny. It was Manny. It was not a question, but the confirmation was immediate as a painful sob came exploding up out of Sarah's tortured chest. "Oh, Sarah, my poor little Sarah." Involuntarily, Aunt Trudy turned her head towards a small framed photograph which stood on the table beside the sick girl's bed. It was a studio photograph of Manfred de la Rey, in boxers, shorts and vest, crouched in the classic pugilist pose, with a silver championship belt around his waist. The inscription read, "To little Sarah, from your big brother, Manny." "What a terrible thing," Aunt Trudy breathed. "What will we do now?" The following afternoon, while Aunt Trudy was in the kitchen, larding a leg of venison, which was a gift from one of the parishioners, Sarah came in on bare feet. "You should not be out of bed, Sarah," Aunt Trudy told her sternly, then was silent as Sarah did not even glance in her direction. The thin white cotton nightdress hung loosely on her wasted frame, and she had to steady herself on the back of a kitchen chair, for she was weak from her sickbed. Then she gathered herself and crossed, like a sleepwalker, to the kitchen range. With the tongs, she lifted the round, black, cast-iron cover off the firebox, and orange points of flame flickered through the opening. Only then did Aunt Trudy realize that Sarah had the photograph of Manfred in her hand. She had removed it from the frame, and she held it up in front of her eyes and studied it for a few seconds, then dropped it into the opening of the firebox. Rapidly the square of cardboard curled and blackened. The image upon it faded to ghostly grey, and then was obscured by flames. With the points of the fire tongs, Sarah stabbed at the scrap of soft ash that remained, crushing and pounding it to powder. Even then, she went on striking the irons into the flames with unnecessary force until there was nothing left. Then she replaced the cast-iron cover over the firebox and dropped the tongs. She swayed on her feet and might have toppled forward onto the hot stove, but Aunt Trudy caught her and steered her to a kitchen chair. Sarah sat staring across the kitchen at the stove for many minutes before she spoke. "I hate him," she said softly, and Aunt Trudy bowed her head over the haunch of venison to hide her eyes. "We have to talk, Sarah," Trudy said softly. "We have to decide what to do." "I know what to do," Sarah said, and the tone chilled Aunt Trudy. It was not the voice of a bright, sweet child, but that of a woman hardened and embittered and coldly angry with what life had offered her. 11 days later, Rolf Stander returned to Stellenbosch, and 6 weeks later he and Sarah were married in the Dutch Reformed Church. Sarah's son was born on the 16th of March, 1937. It was a difficult birth, for the infant was big-boned and she was small-hipped, and her body still not fully recovered from the pneumonia. Rolf was allowed into the delivery room immediately after the birth. He stood over the cot, staring down at the mottled, swollen face of the newborn infant. "Do you hate him, Rolf?" she asked from the bed. Sarah's head was sodden with sweat, and she was drawn and exhausted. Rolf was silent for a few moments while he considered the question. Then he shook his head. "He is a part of you," he said. "I could never hate anything that is you." She held out her hand to him, and he came to stand beside the bed and took it. "You are a kind person," said Sarah. "I will be a good wife to you, Rolf. I promise you that." "I know exactly what you are going to say, Daddy," Matilda Janine sat opposite Blaine in his panelled ministerial office in the Parliament building. "You do you?" Blaine asked. "Then let's hear from you exactly what I'm going to say." "Firstly," Matilda Janine held up her index finger, "you are going to say that David Abrahams is a fine young man, a brilliant law student, and a sportsman of international reputation who won one of the only two medals which this country was awarded at the Berlin Olympics. You are then about to say that he is gentle, considerate, and kind, that he has a marvellous sense of humour and dances beautifully, that he is handsome in a funny sort of way, and would make any girl a wonderful husband. Then you will say, but, and look grave." "I was going to say all that, was I?" Blaine shook his head with wonder. "All right, now I say, but, and look grave. Please continue for me, Matty." "But," you say gravely, "he is Jewish." You will notice the inflection. And now you look not only grave, but significantly grave. "Well, this puts a certain amount of strain on my facial muscles," said Blaine. "Significantly grave. Very well, continue." "My darling Daddy would not be so callow as to add, 'Don't get me wrong, Matty, some of my best friends are Jews.' You would never be as gauche as that, would you?" she asked. "Never." Blaine tried not to grin, even though he was still seriously worried by the proposition. He could never resist the impishness of his plain, carrot-headed but beloved youngest daughter. "I would never say that." "But, you would say," went on Matty, "mixed marriages are very difficult, Matty. Marriage is a hard business without complicating it by different religions and customs and ways of life." "How wise of me," Blaine nodded. "And how would you reply?" "I would tell you that for the past year I have been taking instruction with Rabbi Jacobs, and by the end of next month I will be a Jewess." Blaine winced. "You have never kept anything from me before, Matty." "I told Mummy." "I see." She smiled cheerily, still trying to make a game of it. "Then you would say, 'But, Matty, you are still a baby.'" "And you would reply, 'I will be 18 next birthday,'" said Blaine. "And you would look gruff and say, 'What are David's prospects?'" said Matty. "And you would tell me," said Blaine, "David starts work with Courtney Mining and Finance at the end of the year, with a salary of $2,000 a year." "How did you know that?" Matty was stunned. "David only told me..." She broke off as she realized what his source had been, and she fidgeted in her seat. Her father's relationship with Sante and Courtney troubled her more than she could ever tell him. "Do you love him, Matty?"
"Yes, Daddy, with all my heart."
"And have you already obtained your mother's permission?"
That I can be sure of.
Over the years, both Matilda Janine and Tara had become adept at playing Isabella and Blaine off against each other. Matilda Janine nodded guiltily, and Blaine selected a cheroot from the humidor on his desk. While he prepared it, he frowned thoughtfully.
"It's not a thing to go into lightly, Matty."
"I am not going into it lightly. I've known David 2 years," she replied.
"I always thought you might make a career."
"I am, Daddy. My career is going to be making David happy and giving him lots and lots of babies."
He lit the cheroot and grumbled, "Well then, you'd better send your David to see me. I want to warn him what will happen to him if he doesn't look after my little girl."
Matilda Janine shot round the desk, dumped herself into his lap, and flung both arms around his neck.
"You are the most wonderful father any girl ever had."
"When I give in to you," he qualified the compliment, and she hugged him until her arms and his neck ached.
Shatter and David flew up to Windhoek in the Rapide to fetch A.B. Abrahams and his wife down for the wedding. The rest of David's family and most of his friends, including Dr. Twentyman Jones, came down by train. Together with the friends and family of Matilda Janine Malcolmus, this made up a multitude that filled the great synagogue in the garden suburb to capacity. David would dearly have liked Shatter to act as his best man. However, it had taken some delicate persuasion to get the strictly orthodox Rabbi Jacobs to perform the ceremony for a bride who had clearly converted to the faith for the express purpose of marriage, rather than out of purely religious commitment. David could not, therefore, try to smuggle a Gentile best man into the shul, and Shatter had to be content with the position of pole holder at one corner of the huppah canopy. However, Shatter made a hilariously funny speech at the reception, which Blaine gave at the house in Newlands Avenue, with David as the butt of his wit. The wedding reception provided Shatter with an opportunity to effect one of his periodic reconciliations with Tara Malcolmus. Their relationship over the 2 years since the Berlin Olympics had been storm and sunny weather, alternating so rapidly that even the two protagonists themselves were not always certain as to how matters stood between them at any given time. They managed to occupy opposing grounds on almost every issue. Though politics was their favourite subject of dissension, the plight of the poor and oppressed, in a land where there were plenty of both of these classes, was another perennial winner. Tara could usually find plenty to say about the insensitivity of the privileged, rich, white ruling classes, and the iniquity of a system which enabled a young man, whose only proven distinctions were a beautiful face and a rich and indulgent mother, to number amongst his playthings 15 polo ponies, an SS Jaguar in British Racing Green with the special 3.5-litre engine, and a de Havilland Tiger Moth biplane, while thousands of black children had their little bellies bloated with malnutrition and their legs bowed and deformed by rickets. These subjects did not exhaust their genius at finding contentious issues. Tara had strong views on so-called sportsmen who went out into the veldt armed with high-powered rifles to blast the innocent and beautiful animals and birds, nor did she approve of the obvious relish with which some witless young men regarded the slow but inexorable approach of war clouds for the promise of excitement that they seemed to offer. She was scornful of anyone who was satisfied with a second-class degree when it was apparent that with just a little application they could have finished an expensive education, denied to tens of thousands of others, with a cum laude degree in engineering.